Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. Now, how's it going out there, Bitcoiners? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I've got a discussion with Jan Pritzker, author of Inventing Bitcoin and co-founder CTO of Swan Bitcoin for you all today. Now, you might ask, what is Swan Bitcoin? I haven't heard of that yet. Well, Swan Bitcoin is the new name and brand for the umbrella company that will be home to the Give Bitcoin and Save Bitcoin products. Now, Swan Bitcoin, the brand, is inspired by the work of Nassim Taleb and the idea that Bitcoin is what Taleb calls a black swan, which is a rare and unpredictable outlier event with extreme impact. And if that doesn't describe Bitcoin, I don't know what does. Bitcoin is the biggest black swan event in recent human history. Now, I'm a Taleb fan, and I know founder CEO Corey Clipson is a Taleb fan. I know a lot of Bitcoiners are. I love this branding for the umbrella company. Now, be sure to continue to keep Give Bitcoin in your mind as you're looking for birthday, bar mitzvah, graduation, Valentine's Day gifts. You know, show your love with some Bitcoin. You know, maybe your partner doesn't quite appreciate what Bitcoin is yet, but use Give Bitcoin to give them some of that education and, you know, bring them up to hodler status in a year. By the time next Valentine's Day rolls around, you know, they'll be very appreciative and know exactly how much to value that Bitcoin that you gave them. Make sure you also follow Save Bitcoin on Twitter at @save_Bitcoin to keep up with the latest as we approach the launch of that dead simple, set it and forget it, auto stacking straight from your bank account to the Bitcoin ledger, Bitcoin savings account, your Bitcoin savings account. It's going to be awesome. All right, a couple quick shout outs today before we move on. First, my merch partner, Nick Ward at Layer 1 BTC. Go to layer1btc.com, click partners, and then Citizen Bitcoin. Check out the merch collection that supports this podcast. And also a big thank you to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin Pod in the LTBN family of great Bitcoin podcasts. If you're listening on the LTBN feed, I welcome to you. I hope to be part of your Bitcoin journey going forward. Now, if you like what you hear, you can find a growing archive of great shows on the web at citizenbitcoin.world. And please do follow LTBN on Bitcoin Twitter at the LTB Network and subscribe to the LTBN feed for more great Bitcoin content all in one place. All right, let's go. All right, I'm excited to welcome Jan Pritzker, author of Inventing Bitcoin and CTO of Swan Bitcoin, the new umbrella company for Give Bitcoin and the soon-to-launch Save Bitcoin. Welcome, Jan. How's it going, man?
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here, really excited. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. I'm excited for the conversation, too. Okay, let's start. You have a really interesting personal history, and I think it's really relevant to Bitcoin. You immigrated from the former Soviet Union to the U.S. Mm-hmm. So what were the circumstances and like motivations to make that move? And how might the existence of Bitcoin have made a difference for you and the people of Russia at that time?
Yeah, I think so when I was seven, my family moved from the former Soviet Union to the United States. You know, life in the Soviet Union was not easy. I mean, I was a kid, so I didn't know as much about what life should be like. And neither did my parents really, because the flow of information into the Soviet Union was very, very limited. So we didn't really know what America was like, you know, what other things were out there. But we were living in a very, you know, a socialist economy, right? So there were shortages everywhere. We had to stand in line for things, and you pretty much just stood in line whenever you saw a line and you just took whatever was available that day. And there was a very big black market for trading goods that people actually needed. You know, my parents, I think, felt that was something wrong with the situation. And also after Chernobyl happened, which was in 1986, they started getting the idea that, like, you know, this is not maybe not the best country to be living in. I don't know if you saw that series that just came out, but it was kind of like illustrating all the cover-ups that the government went through to kind of say everything was just fine, even though people were dying.
Yeah, I did see that. It was crazy.
It was that kind of, it was a very you know, controlling environment, as those types of places tend to be. So in 1989, we finally were able to leave. There was a period of time where people were not able to leave because, I mean, essentially the government didn't want anybody coming in or out. But in 89, that was a little bit relaxed and we were able to leave. Although when we left, we were only able to exchange some of our money. Mm-hmm. So we had Soviet rubles, which were kind of, you know, basically like Venezuelan bolivars are today, a garbage currency that nobody else really wanted. It worked internally to the country because all the prices were fixed. But outside of the Soviet Union, nobody wanted those rubles. So the government actually exchanged $100 per person worth of currency.
Wow.
Then that's what we left with, right? So that's like, you know, that's what real capital controls look like. And that's something that I think a lot of folks here in America don't really understand. And so like when we had to leave, we couldn't really take our wealth with us. We had some suitcases with some junk that we'd try to sell. And then, you know, $100 per person. So that's it. That's what we got.
I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that's, you know, essentially all your wealth that you have to give up and just start completely over from scratch.
Right. Wow. And that's I think the problem that Bitcoin solves that a lot of people don't understand. Like that's to me, you know, aside from all the sort of problems we have with inflation and all that kind of stuff in the first world, the real problem Bitcoin solves, I think, is like capital controls, right? The ability to say this money is mine, this is my wealth, and I want to take it with me if I want to leave. Because not allowing people to take their wealth with them is a form of oppression, and that basically keeps people inside of these authoritarian regimes. And that's what really got me interested in Bitcoin once I really understood what it was. I saw it as a type of freedom money, right? I could, you know, imagine if my family had Bitcoin in Soviet Union 25 years prior, and we were building up this little stash, even if it was like $1 a month, right?
Yeah.
We started to have this pot of wealth that is actually portable. And that gives you options. You know, you can leave a country that's failing if you have those options. But if you're completely tied down to the whims of the government and what they do with the currency and how they manage the economy, you know, you're in a bad place. You don't have your freedom if you don't have your money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, yeah, your money is really the representation of your will. It's the representation of your choices, the ability to make those choices. And so, yeah, it's essentially, you know, it's almost more fundamental to freedom than even the freedom of speech. I guess it's really a form of speech.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I think especially in a, you know, quote unquote democracy where you're supposed to vote, if we really look at how voting works, you're not really voting for like an arbitrary pool of people. You're voting for people that were preselected by money. So if you're not able to even, you know, spend that money to exercise your economic power, or whether, you know, whether it be for political candidates or for stuff you buy at the store, right, to like indicate that you're interested in one type of product versus another, you're basically losing the freedom to make personal choices. And so, yeah, money is absolutely fundamental to that. And that's why Bitcoin is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. How old were you when you came over?
I was seven. I was like 7 and a half.
So you're pretty young. Cool. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. So most of this, I actually, you know, a lot of this, what I know is not from my memory, but rather from asking my parents about how it was and also from researching online. And I really only started doing that once I got into Bitcoin because I never thought about this stuff growing up. I never thought about money or how freedom and money interact. I briefly was kind of libertarian leaning in college, and I went to a few meetups and stuff, but I never really got into it. I never really thought about like, what is that link between freedom and money?
Yeah, me neither, man. Me neither. And I talk about that on the pod all the time. And yeah, it's increasingly Bitcoiners are like that. They're being taught what money really is by Bitcoin itself. I remember doing a poll a while back and asking Bitcoiners if they had learned about Austrian economic ideas before or after they got into Bitcoin. And it was almost exactly, split, two-thirds of the answers. And it was like, you know, statistically significant because it was like over 3,000 answers, right? So yeah, 66% said that they found out about what money really is in Austrian economic ideas after getting into Bitcoin, 33% before. And I, you know, if I would have asked that question 5 years ago, I think it would have been flipped or maybe even like 80-20. Mm-hmm. The other way.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely interesting. I was running a similar poll on Twitter about like whether people had an economics background or technology background and whether they understood or didn't understand Bitcoin at first. And, you know, I'm a technology guy and I didn't have any economics background getting into Bitcoin. And I heard about Bitcoin in 2011 and 2013 and both times did not actually like understand what it was or research it. It wasn't until 2016 that I dove in. And I found that this was actually a common pattern. People who had a technology background saw it as a tech play, thought it was interesting, didn't think much of it. People with like a strong background in economics or even people who were like gold bugs who had some understanding of what sound money looks like, they actually had an easier time seeing Bitcoin. And now I think a lot of others, like people like me and other people who don't necessarily have that economics background are coming in and they're coming in with this, you know, with a blank slate on economics and they're seeing like, oh, Bitcoin works despite that people say deflationary money can't work, blah, blah, blah. like it's working and it's growing, and you know, nothing really explains that really well except for the Austrian school. Yep. So I definitely think that's something that's worth studying, and I'm only just kind of diving in myself. Signed up for Safe Dean's course, highly recommend that. I'm only about halfway through, I'm super behind, but it's been really fun to learn.
Yeah, it's a lot to keep up with. I was in the first cohort, and I couldn't quite keep up with all the reading. So I might go through the course again, I think.
Yeah, I'm going through at my own pace because it's just, you know, I have too much going on to be able to go weekly, but I think it's a good, it's a good, you know, forcing function to really start learning about life.
yes. Okay. So I want to go back, when you mentioned that your parents, you were talking to your parents about Bitcoin. So what do they think about Bitcoin?
Well, they understand, I think, more than most people of their age. they kind of like got the idea about the freedom money, and my dad's actually bought some Bitcoin on my edging or egging or yeah. whatever that is. He's a technology guy too. So he kind of looked at it as an interesting distributed system. And when I explained to him, you know, this is kind of like a new digital money, but nobody's in charge. There's a whole bunch of computers. He was really interested mm-hmm. in just how it worked. And I think that's what got him excited. My mom is, you know, she's relatively passive on this stuff, but they both embrace my career in the space. I think they trust me. They see that I have a lot of interest and passion for this. And I think that's the most important thing, is that Bitcoin, it is a passion project for a lot of people. I think a lot of people see Bitcoin as a big force of good in the world, despite all the bad media headlines that you sometimes get, right? I think all of us that are actually in Bitcoin, who have actually studied it and who've actually interacted with other Bitcoiners, we know that there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. And that's why we're doing it, right? And I think that my parents definitely support
Yeah, you get that sense. When you fall down the rabbit hole, you're like, oh, wow, there's so much going on here. And then it just leads to an education or even a re-education on so many topics. Like we talked about, obviously, economics and money. But even beyond that, you know, all the tech, what is peer-to-peer networking? What is, what is proof of work? What is the idea of digital scarcity? How does that actually happen? And then, yeah, it just goes on from there. The follow-on effects of true scarcity, personal responsibility, and I've talked about this on the pod too. It's kind of changed my habits as a person. And I, think longer term, I'm less, my time preferences has shifted. And follow-on effects of that is
it's funny because I've gotten really annoyed at like spending small amounts of money now. Like I used to just, okay, this is $20. I don't care. But now I'm like, oh, this is like, why are we paying for this? Do we really need this? And, should I just stack some stats instead? It's just, it definitely changes the way you're thinking and, delaying frivolous purchases. Like, it's essentially a high interest paying. Well, it's not interest, but you used to be able to keep money in a bank account and it would grow at some, at some rate or even a bond or something. But nowadays that's gone. So people aren't used to the idea of saving anymore. They're like, if you have money, you spend it or you throw it in the stock market or whatever like that. But that's, that's risky. But with Bitcoin, I think of it now as like I can actually save this money. It's an actual savings account. It actually grows or at least stores its value. So now I can defer my purchases and, save up for something nicer.
I've done that too. I started keeping track of like, I'll go out to a bar or something and instead of buying like three beers, I'll just drink like one beer and drink it slowly and enjoy playing darts and foosball. And I'll say like, all right, that's $7 saved. I'll stick it on a spreadsheet at the end of the month. I add that to my, my sats buy. And not only that, so like, that's just a good example. Now I'm drinking less, right? I'm like, I've taken care of myself just from thinking longer term, right? Taking better care of myself, I've actually started procrastinating less. used to be a huge procrastinator. I still am, but I'm working on that habit and it's...
Yeah. I want to say I started procrastinating less, but I'm still working on
that.
Yeah,
me too. But I feel like more motivated to make money so I can stack sats, especially right now because of what's, the potential opportunity,
For
and
sure.
And going back to your point that you just made, like moving the way that money is now, negative interest rates and easy money really does encourage people to like, put their money into something that will, grow in value because the money itself is not growing in value. You mentioned stock markets, real estate, art, something that's actually scarce, the money's not scarce anymore. And so it's not only risky, but it's like leading to this fundamental change in the nature of our economy and the way things work. It's you know, leads to these large bubbles. And it's, you know, it's unsafe, and it creates an economy where value accrues to the top. And if you look at the, and I, you know, I mentioned this every podcast, it seems now, shout out to Ben Prentice and mm-hmm. what WTF happened in 1971 and Colin at the Bitcoin. Yeah. Love Bitcoin Echo Chamber too. Yeah. So those guys put that productivity chart, right? Go to that site, look at all the charts, mm-hmm. but the one that always sticks to me is productivity. Going up in tandem until 1971 and they split off, wages just go flatline. Productivity continues to rise. Yep. It's, you know, it's theft of our increasing productivity, our time and our ingenuity.
Yep. Yeah. And all that money is accruing, you know, to people who are asset owners, people who have equities and stuff like that. But how long is that going to go on for? You know, we have all this massive printing of money. We have, you know, not QE, QE, infinity, whatever's going on right now. And a lot of people don't realize this is happening. And I didn't know this was happening either. Like, even up until recently, I heard about QE. I didn't understand what it was. I didn't understand what had been going on since 2008. And then you have, you know, like with Trump yelling, the stock market's at all-time highs. This is amazing. I did this. It's like, well, yeah, but we also quadrupled our money supply. So, you know, it's like the president has a lot less to do with it than the central bank, I would argue, that is making money so easy to acquire for the people who have access to it, right? The people at the top who can take out those very low interest loans and just, you know, pump up their own stock price. That's what's happening. And I don't think most people understand that. And I also think that people don't get that we're living in a new type of monetary regime that actually is an experiment. People say that Bitcoin is an experiment, but, you know, gold-backed money only ended in 1971.
Yep.
So that's a pretty recent development in our history, and that's an experiment. We're living in a big experiment.
Bitcoin is like it's like we were saying. Bitcoin is deprogramming us. It's like waking us up to what money really is. It's
and it is. It makes you ask questions, right? I think that's the best thing about Bitcoin is that it is a rabbit hole, and it's a forcing function. Like, once you have Bitcoin in your possession, you really want to understand what it is that you just bought. Like, why is this number going up? Why is it not dying? Like, everybody keeps saying that it's dead, but it just doesn't seem to die. What is happening here? And then you have to ask yourself questions about what is the nature of money. And that's something that most people aren't prepared to deal with. I think it's like something you don't want to think about. Money works day to day, at least in America here. Like, you go to a store, you spend your dollar, it works. It's fine. It appears stable because most people aren't used to thinking about long time horizons. They're not looking at their dollars and saying, okay, what could this dollar buy me 10 years from now or 10 years ago? They're using it day to day, and maybe they have some memory that prices seem to have doubled in the last couple of years, but they don't really know how that happened, why that happened. It's like normal life.
Yep.
So waking up from this life and saying, wait a minute, it doesn't have to be this way. That's like, that's a big deal, right? It's a different type of thinking, and it is really something that Bitcoin stimulates.
So you're right. You're getting at this idea that it's not just about spreading knowledge, the knowledge of what money really is and this alternative idea of what money is. It's also this kind of deep psychological and emotional effect on people. And it's, as a result, it's inspiring this kind of zealous devotion to the cause of spreading the knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, I think like for me, it's all about freedom, right? I'm always trying to work on something that will kind of make a dent, you know, leave a legacy, something that will change the world for the better. I know it sounds kind of corny, but like, I want the world to be better for my children, right? And that's why I work on Bitcoin, because I think that it does change things in a big way. It frees people from oppressive regimes. It gives people freedom with their money, their thoughts, their lives, their, you know, where they live. Like, these things need to be a part of the world we live in, because it's either that or we're going to head down a very dark path. And that's another thing I think people don't get is that money is going digital. It's not like a question. It's just really more of a matter of time, right? Like, I don't think it's not a controversial idea to say that maybe 50 years from now, like, all money will be digital, right? All transactions will be digital, except for some really, really fringe, you know, stuff that's happening in black market with, like, you know, gold or diamonds or maybe Bitcoin, right?
And the Amish community.
the Amish community. But I mean, most people day to day, they're going to go digital, and it's not even going to be because they're forced into it. It's just going to be a convenience thing.
Yeah.
Like, most people use credit cards because of convenience. They use Apple Pay because of convenience. And this convenience thinking will drive all of us into digital money. And then the question is, what is that good, right? Is it good that we have digital money? Well, it is very convenient, but it also means that every single transaction is now tracked, cataloged, monitored, surveilled, and possibly censored, right? Like, we have legal cannabis here in Illinois, just went legal, but I can't go to the store and buy it with my credit card. So there's already censorship there, right? So the only reason I can buy cannabis today is because cash exists. So what happens when cash goes away? What else can I not access, right? And now you're completely at the whims of the powers that be that determine the laws, and they're not always aligned with what you might want as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the trend is absolutely clear. Like you mentioned, that we're moving to digital money for digital age, and that corresponds with, you know, that this is sort of like a generational shift, right? It just makes sense to millennials and the younger Gen Xers that mm-hmm. discover Bitcoin that we're going to have digital money for digital natives. It just makes sense to them. So this seems like largely a generational shift. Do you think that'll play into Bitcoin's adoption timeline?
Yeah, I definitely believe in that. I really like what, so there is Dan Tapiero. He's a macro investor, gold guy. And he's been going around and kind of like explaining Bitcoin to people in his world. And he said that pretty much everybody over 50 just like doesn't really want to look at it. It's very rare. Mm-hmm. Under 30, they're like all into it. Under 40. And then like if depending on where you are in between, that age range is kind of a gray sliding scale as to whether you're even receptive to the idea of Bitcoin. And so I definitely think there's a generational component, just like it's hard for my grandparents to use email, but it's easy for my parents. It's a little bit harder for my parents to do texting, although now they're pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. It was hard initially. There's different types of technologies that are adapted by different generations. And we already see that in Bitcoin. If you look at, you know, what millennials are buying, I mean, millennials aren't buying gold by and large. Like they don't care about gold. It's a foreign object. It doesn't make any sense in the digital age. So for them or for us, I mean, I'm a millennial, or I'm on the borderline. It's more of a recognition that we are living in a digital society. Like I grew up with PayPal and Venmo and all these things. I understand digital money. It's completely normal to me. So for me, it's just a question of which digital money. Is it the one that's controlled by the banks or the one that's the freedom money? And being that, you know, I'm into freedom, it seems like the freedom money is the better one, right? And I think more and more people will realize that once given that option staring them in the face. And I do think that affects the timeline. I think that's, you know, it's going to be me, it's going to be my children, and those are the people who are going to adopt Bitcoin. And so, you know, Bitcoin's adoption is kind of, it's two things, right? One is necessity. Like if you live in Venezuela and it doesn't matter how old you are, if you see that your neighbors are like surviving by mining Bitcoin or something, then maybe you're going to look into that.
Right.
But if you live in America, Bitcoin is basically a luxury good for you in America. It's an investment. It's a speculation. It's not life and death, right? So for most Americans, the sell is like you can make money on this and the number go up. And that's fine, right? That gives value to Bitcoin and that helps people all over the world who are in worse circumstances. But I think for first world countries like in the USA, it's going to be very much the younger people that start embracing Bitcoin because their mind is more flexible, they're more open to new ideas, and they're more willing to question the status quo, especially when the status quo doesn't look so good for them.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, and we're onto this, you know, with the idea of Save Bitcoin, that product and service that's going to come out soon from Swan Bitcoin. It's in the first world. It's becoming not just a speculation, but more understood as a savings technology for people in the first world.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that's something that people have realized slowly over time. You see a lot of early Bitcoiners think of Bitcoin as a payments technology because initially it looked like that, right? It had really cheap fees because nobody was using it and all that kind of stuff. And if you really look at Bitcoin, what is the invention of Bitcoin? It's not fast payments. We already had that. The invention is digital scarcity. And what does digital scarcity enable? It enables the idea that is something that people would desire, that they would actually commit value to, and know that their value commitment isn't going to be eroded by inflation. And the more people that realize that Bitcoin is that one thing that is digital, that is also scarce, the more they want to buy it because they see that other people are buying it, right? And it's a reflexive, recursive kind of effect. So I do think people are starting to recognize Bitcoin as a savings vehicle. I mean, much like gold, right? Like you can have some money in gold, but you're not going to go to the grocery store and buy goods with gold. And you're certainly not going to send gold online to anybody. So the idea of Bitcoin is that you have this thing that's kind of like in between a cash and a gold, right? Because as a store of value, you're buying it because it's scarce. And then you may or may not transact with it. Maybe you're going to sit on it for 30 years, right? Maybe you'll pass it on to your grandkids and maybe they'll use it in the future. And maybe they're only going to use it for really, really large purchases like buying a house, right? We don't know what the actual use cases of Bitcoin will look like, but I think it's pretty clear that we can look at it as a savings technology, as a way to squirrel away value in a way that can't be eroded. And then as you need that in the future, you dip into that pot and you take out that value. And if you need to leave the country or move somewhere, and you know you don't have to worry about capital controls, you don't have to worry about any of that. You now have true portable wealth. It's really censorship resistant, really seizure proof, and all of that kind of stuff.
Self-sovereign money. And, you know, new people to Bitcoin will look at the price and they'll be like, "Are you freaking crazy? Like, this is not a savings technology. It's lost 85% of its value in the last 2 years. What are you talking about?" But if you look at it on more like a 10-year time scale, if you think about it as like a 10-year certificate of deposit, right? Then yeah, it's the best performing asset of the last decade.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, we don't know that if it's going to repeat that same performance.
Sure.
But if our, you know, at the very least, we know that it's not being eroded by inflation, right? I think people used to give, you know, bonds as like I got a bond for my bar mitzvah, right? It was, I think at the time, paying, you know, 5% or more. And so like I held it for however long, 10 years or whatever it was, right? Nowadays, you can't even really gift bonds anymore, right? You can't, there's no real savings vehicle you can gift to somebody who's coming of age to say like, "Here, hold on to this for a while." It makes no sense. All it does is lose value.
Right.
So what are you going to give
Bitcoin
them?
Fixes this.
Give Bitcoin fixes this. That's right. I mean, you want to give them something that retains its value. And if it grows, then that's great. But at the very least, it can't be eroded by any governments or external events or third parties. You know that this thing is yours. This is a true piece of digital scarcity that you own and you alone. And I think that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you think governments will react if, you know, if and when, like down the road, Bitcoin replaces gold as the preferred store of value? What will governments do, do you think?
Well, this is, this is a big question, right? But I think we're already starting to see some of the effects of this. We've already had Bitcoin debated on the floor of Congress.
Yeah.
And I think there's two camps here. One, you have people realizing that Bitcoin is unstoppable. They've literally, you know, said that, right? Like the chairman of the banking committee, Mike Crapo, said, like, Bitcoin is an unstoppable global force. You know, we can't do it. We can't do anything about it. And so they're seeing it as like something to embrace, right? Because if we can't stop it, then we might as well join it. Bitcoin can end up being a huge force of good for this country, right? It could bring jobs. We have mining jobs. We have Texas becoming a major mining hub now. And, you know, all those jobs that, you know, certain presidents promised in the coal industry, well, maybe coal mining is not really like the future. Maybe Bitcoin mining is the future. And that's what we're going to bring in the jobs, right? And wouldn't that be funny if that's what brought jobs into America? But, you know, if they see it as an unstoppable force, they're going to have to embrace it. And I think the other side of it is that you have people like Sherman who wants to basically shut it down. Well, that's also validating Bitcoin as something that's scary and powerful, right? It's actually challenging people in the government to think about what money is, how money works, and where we derive our value from. And the thing is, if they try to shut it down in any way and they fail, what is that going to do to Bitcoin? That's just going to make it 10 times stronger. Everybody's going to know about it. It's going to be a massive Streisand effect where everybody who never heard about Bitcoin now is all of a sudden, you know, asking questions. It's just like when Trump tweeted about it, he said, "I don't like Bitcoin," but he tweeted it to 60 million followers.
Oh, it's happened over and over. It's happened over and over in Bitcoin's history.
Right? It doesn't matter what you say about Bitcoin.
Mt. Gox lost everyone's money, you know, on Bitcoin.
And then
it immediately went up to $1,000 a coin, you know?
Exactly. Or like China banned it, right? China banned it how many times now?
Yeah.
5-7 times?
Yeah.
Every time the price just goes up. So it's just they're reinforcing Bitcoin's core value proposition, which is that it is money outside of government. It's separation of money and state. And so anytime states interfere with Bitcoin and fail, it's just reinforcing that value proposition and driving adoption. So I think it's absolutely great. I would love more attacks on Bitcoin. And, you know, it's just going to start to permeate everything. And at some point, it's just going to be the countries that are wise enough are going to accept it and say, okay, this is the new reality. And, you know, maybe we put it on our balance sheet as a central bank. Maybe we encourage Bitcoin companies to set up shop in our country, bring in jobs. This is the future as I see it. It's just going to be a matter of time.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, the fact that we've seen the chairman of the Federal Reserve refer to Bitcoin as a savings technology like gold, we've seen Bitcoin debated on the floor of Congress, thanks to Libra for bringing that up, by the way. You know, we had the phrase, you know, there's Bitcoin and there's shitcoin, which is one of my favorite things in the whole world. That was
amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
Patrick McHenry. Shout out to Patrick McHenry.
Yeah, it was Warren Davidson that said the shitcoin thing, but then Patrick...
Oh, sorry. Yes, yeah.
Patrick McHenry was even more amazing. He said Bitcoin's an unstoppable force.
Yes. Right? Shout out to both of those guys.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, I mean, we're seeing these politicians in the most influential country in the world, in the country that, you know, has control over the money that's the global standard for the monetary base for the whole world. You know, to me, that signals, like, that's optimistic development for me, that signals that we might have this kind of peaceful transition or relatively peaceful transition. I know that, like, the US government and other governments that make their own money are not going to give that up lightly, obviously, and that there's going to be a battle, but seeing that happen, that debate happen within that kind of, you know, democratic context makes me hopeful that the battle will happen in the political realm and not the physical realm, right?
Yeah. And I think that there is a world where Bitcoin doesn't necessarily replace the dollar, but ends up being like gold, right? Like, nobody's trying to shut down gold, even though there's $7 trillion worth of value parked in there. And that's a lot of money.
Yep.
But it's possible that the US government is friendly to Bitcoin. It brings in jobs, lets people save, you know, and if they want to spend, turn that into dollars and spend it later, that's fine. So I'm a little bit skeptical around, like, people who say hyper-Bitcoinization is going to happen, in the sense that Bitcoin replaces all money, even though it looks to me like a better money than you know, the US dollar and other things like that. I think the power of national governments is very strong. And I don't think we're going to see the U.S. government just, like, lay down its arms and say, okay, yeah, we're not going to collect taxes in U.S. dollars anymore.
Yeah.
It just seems like relatively far-fetched. I mean, I could be wrong, but I see it more like Bitcoin is that kind of freedom money. It's a separate savings vehicle.
Yeah.
And people are saving in it and people are storing their wealth in it. And it doesn't really threaten governments that much. I mean, I think it works nicely alongside governments. It may help them shrink a little bit. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, we have things on the horizon, like the MMT crowd who wants to just print money to infinity. And if they do that, then they're going to find themselves in trouble.
Yep.
But if they're responsible and they, you know, figure out how to scale things back, then maybe these two things can coexist. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those are the kind of two outcomes is, if governments do not rein things in, and, you know, Saifedean says that the best option for governments is to go back on a gold standard, you know, if they want to compete with Bitcoin. But if they don't, and they just continue to print money, like this MMT, like, economic ideology is proposing, then eventually over time, you know, as hyperinflation takes over, you know, or even not hyperinflation, but just, like, pretty quick inflation. It doesn't have to be super bad, you know. Then we have, you know, this alternative sitting in, you know, waiting in the wings. And as Bitcoin supply rate decreases, right, that, you know, the volatility will decrease. And as the adoption increases, if we, you know, if Bitcoin replaces gold as a store of value, or even just competes with it on the same level as a store of value, then, you know, we have a much, like, a better incentive as holders of Bitcoin to start spending it. One, it's going to be demanded more because it's a better money by, you know, producers of goods and services. But also it's, you know, the upside of potential, you know, increase in dollar value of Bitcoin is going to be a lot less at that point.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we're going to see some of that happening. And we don't know what the time scale for this kind of, like, infinite printing of money is, or how long really the current regime is sustainable for. You know, I mean, people have been predicting the collapse of this whole system for a long time. But you know, we keep pumping the stock market and, you know, everything's going up and up and up and up. And, you know, this could last another 50 years, I think, easily. And then if that happens, then we need to be prepared for that. And we just need to be building up this, you know, inflation-resistant savings vehicle so we can be prepared for these environments where, if we think we have, you know, $1 million today, that's not really $1 million anymore in 10 years, right?
Exactly.
So it's like you need to be looking at different ways to save that wealth, or $1,000. You know, really, whatever it is that you have, like, protect your wealth, right?
Yep.
We are living in an experiment. Like I said, we don't know that any of this is sustainable or when it'll end.
Yeah, we've got these competing experiments now, and it's going to be a fascinating battle to watch.
Yeah, but the cool thing is that we have the choice now, right?
Exactly.
We have a true free market competition for money.
Yep.
And may the better money win.
Absolutely.
I do think that it's going to take a while for Bitcoin to really be ready to onboard that many people too, right? We need to think about what that looks like, quote unquote, scalability. How do people like start earning Bitcoin, circular economies, whatever it may be, that actually gets us to the point where Bitcoin is an everyday currency. Because it very well could happen that never happens, right? It could, like I said, it could happen that Bitcoin is a savings account. You've got your wealth parked in it and, you know, that's all it is. That could happen and that could still make a major, major dent in the world. Or we could go to the next level. And I think it's going to depend a little bit on what's happening outside of Bitcoin as well.
Yeah, I am pretty certain we're going to go to that next level. I'm just uncertain exactly on the time frame, you know. Yeah, but I think the truth of sound money will exert itself over time. Even if governments try to compete, there's still the inefficiency of having multiple national currencies to take into account and having versus having one global a currency that's, you know, borderless and, you know, much, much more frictionless, et cetera. So there's other advantages that Bitcoin will have as it matures over a national currency, you know. But,
cool.
You know, other people people will always continue to print easy money, like it's whether or not it's nations or people, because right. People can just do it now. You know, there's
well, yeah. I mean, just 1,000 different altcoins.
It's exactly. It's the it's the highest like, you know, difficulty to reward scam in the world. You know, so it'll continue.
Yeah, I mean, they're really out of control with that stuff. But I think that's another thing is that it's education, right? I mean, I think when we had like the first major fork of Bitcoin, people were a little bit confused. Then we had a second fork, then we had a third fork, and now we have a dozen forks.
Yep.
I don't think it's confusing anymore. I think it's pretty obvious, or at least for us that are in the space. I think we still have some ways to go to educate the general public on why, you know, a Bitcoin fork is not the same thing as Bitcoin. And that's a big question that people ask. But like I've been sort of really coming back to it as a market phenomenon, right? And saying, look, if any of these were similar to Bitcoin, why are they worth so much less? Like there's no reason for Bitcoin Cash to be worth less than 3% of Bitcoin if it's like the same thing, right?
Right.
So it's clearly not the same thing by a long shot, by like, you know, 97-3 or 98-2, it's not the same thing. So, but why? And I think that makes people ask questions about money. What are the characteristics of money? And we have to come back to that. Bitcoin is the invention of digital scarcity. I really love this. I don't have the exact quote, but Knut Svanholm, who just wrote Sovereignty Through Mathematics of Bitcoin, really great Bitcoin primer. And in this Bitcoin book, he talks about that Bitcoin is the invention of digital scarcity. And so the idea that you can just reproduce it, that is in and of itself, you know, counterfactual to the invention, right? So any fork of Bitcoin isn't scarce. There's no scarcity of forks. You can make as many forks as you want, but there's only one Bitcoin. And I think it's going to take people a while to realize that.
Yeah, I'm going to have Knut on the pod next week, actually. So
that's great.
A nice little preview.
Love his book.
Yeah, me too. All right, let's switch up gears from talking about money. Let's dive back into tech. We talked about how you got into tech after you'd come over here, studied it, started working in tech. So when was that? I mean, did you study it in college, and have you been in tech your whole career?
I actually got into tech really early on. My dad, thankfully, bought me a computer when I was 8 years old. So nice. As soon as we moved here, like pretty much he hustled on some side jobs, saved up enough money to buy a Commodore 64.
Nice.
Which was a really
classic.
Early classic. It was great. I had a bunch of games. And I actually started learning basic programming. And at the time, there was a children's magazine where they used to publish programs. You could like type in a program from this magazine into your computer and you'd have a little game. So I did a little bit of that, and then towards junior high, I already started coding for real, like more serious stuff. And so, yeah, I just grew up coding a lot and went to school for computer science because it seemed to be the thing to do when you have a background like mine. But I already knew a lot going in, so I kind of slacked off in college, honestly.
Same.
But what I did do, what I did do in college that was really good is I worked at a bunch of companies that were like on campus, tech startups or tech companies of different kinds. So I got a lot of real world experience, and then I just came out of school and just went into like doing startups. and got so caught up in doing startups that I basically missed Bitcoin because I was just doing other stuff and I was just not paying attention.
That's like the exact same story as me, man. I was just all into tech, and I'd started college, but realized that I just wanted to go out to Silicon Valley or something and start working in tech. And I was working in tech already, working for companies. I was like, consulting. I started working for a government agency in Topeka, Kansas, and started built their first website, wrote this Medicare supplement premium comparison app. It was the first in the country, open sourced it back then. This was very late 90s, sent it around to other agencies in other states, and they started using it. It was kind of crazy. And I was like, all right, Dad, I want to go and do this. I want to get out of here and go just work in tech. I'm going to drop out. And he's like, no, man, you can't drop out. I've worked really, really, really hard to save up money to pay your way through college. You got to get your degree. It's gonna be
you're pot committed now.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, why don't you just save all that money? And he's like, the degree is really important. And it was his dream to put me through college. So I ended up just majoring in English, so I could read books. I mean, there was no web curriculum at that point.
I kind of wish I went back and majored in something else at this point because, who knows what my career would have been like without that degree? But it was interesting. I learned a bunch of stuff. It's not like what you learn in school with computer science is very low level stuff that you don't really use in real life. We learned how to build a computer from scratch, which is fun. And I learned a ton doing that, but did I ever use that skill? No. And now you have kids that are going into these boot camps for 12 weeks and they're just as good, coming out as, they need help. They need onboarding and they need to have some real world experience, but do you need a 4-year degree to code? Not really.
Nah.
But I think there's a difference between computer science and development or computer engineering. And I think of myself much more as a kind of product engineer, somebody who just builds stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in the user experience and how people interact with products than I am in the code per se. And I think that, you don't necessarily need to be a computer science major to do that.
Absolutely.
But it was, it was fun. I don't know what's going to happen to colleges because the tuition costs are getting so crazy. And like I said, you could pay $12,000 or $15,000 and get the same thing from a vocational boot camp or even self-study if you're motivated enough.
Yeah.
So, unknown.
If you're into Bitcoin, just, go through a Safedine's class and then go to Biddle Boot Camp or the like, and boom, you're done.
Take Jimmy Song's class. I actually did that when I got into Bitcoin. I took Jimmy Song's programming Bitcoin class. And that was a fun class because it was super challenging. He would lecture for 5 minutes and then for the next 5 minutes, you'd have to write code to do what he just taught you about. So it was super, I'm a good coder and it was tough for me to keep up with the class. It was boom, 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 5 minutes, 5 minutes, just alternate. And then, he said it was a semester worth of education in 2 days and it's legit. It's it's very intense. It's what school should be like.
Yeah.
Because you're really forced to learn, you can't just slack off.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you've been in tech for a long time. You probably kind of studied the history or just aware of it through osmosis of the internet, development of the protocols, all that stuff. So we had TCP/IP in the 70s, SMTP in the 80s and others, HTTP in the early 90s. Then we had in the early 2000s, BitTorrent and Tor. And the Bitcoin protocol is built on top of all of these things. We're watching the emergence of the Lightning protocol now. What do you think we can glean about the future of the Bitcoin and Lightning protocols from the history of, these other networking protocols?
That's a great question. We're going to have to edit this out because I need to go and plug my computer in.
Okay, no worries.
It's dying.
Yeah.
And then I will answer the question.
No problem.
Unless you want to keep this on for, a more realistic view of what life is like interviewing people.
Where's my...
Who haven't plugged in their laptop.
Where's my plug-in? Same thing actually happened to Andreas when we were recording.
Really?
Yeah, he had
okay,
to,
cool.
I'm he had to shout one. Out. He's like, someone bring me my power cord. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, I'm going to... I still have to listen to that one. I'm so behind on Bitcoin pods right now. It's unbelievable.
There's so many, man.
There's so many. And hold on. Let me get a power cable here. Okay.
Nice.
Let's see if we're back. Oh. All right. Testing, testing. Okay. I think we're back online.
Yep, got you.
Awesome. Yeah. So the question was about the history of internet protocols and how that relates to Bitcoin.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting to look at, TCP/IP in particular, which is essentially the protocol underlying the entire internet stack. And it hasn't changed much since it's been released. And that's because it doesn't do that much. TCP/IP basically defines like packets, which are just, little bits of information traveling between computers. And it essentially tells us what those packets should look like and how they should behave and how computers should make sure that they're getting the right packets and all that kind of stuff. And by keeping the protocol relatively low surface area, right, that enables other things to be built as layers on top of it. So when we talk about email or the web, these are all protocols built on top of TCP/IP that didn't have to really go in and TCP/IP and change it because TCP/IP is just a messaging definition protocol, right? Just saying, here's how we communicate. And then we build the next layer. Here's how we communicate when we do web. Here's how we communicate when we do email, right? We change. We have different ways of doing that. So I see a similar thing with Bitcoin where Bitcoin surface area should be extremely small. Bitcoin is about defining scarcity, right? Here's how we ensure that the money is scarce. Here's how we ensure that transactions are properly propagated. Here's how we know that blocks are authentic and not counterfeited. We have these things defined in the protocol, right? But once we get to other types of functionality, that's where we can build layers. And that's how I see the Lightning Network, right? So the Lightning Network, for example, is a nice way to transact quickly, more privately, but we don't necessarily have to go and modify Bitcoin in order to build Lightning, or at least we had to make one minor change, which is to get SegWit in.
Right.
But my understanding was Lightning was actually possible even without SegWit. It's just a lot better with SegWit.
Yep. Yep.
But essentially, we're building these layers, and so when we build a layered system, with computer engineering, we're almost always building layered systems. Because layers enable us to do different things with different layers and optimize each layer for its own best use case. So Bitcoin-based layer is absolutely optimized for immutability. We don't want it to change. We need to know that our money is actually hard, is actually sound, is actually immutable. And so that's like critical, right? And then other layers might be about being fast, more private, more secure, not secure, but security is at the base layer. But,
yeah.
Different properties that we make trade-offs with, right? And also it enables a lot more experimentation because with Lightning, we have at least, I think, three different competing implementations. With Bitcoin, there are other implementations besides Bitcoin Core, but they have to be so extremely backwards compatible that it's not common for people to run other implementations just because there are more risks of bugs.
Yep.
Whereas with Lightning, no problem. You want to experiment. You want to define new features in one client that's not compatible with another client. Well, that's something you could do and you can experiment. And then those implementations can agree on standards as they emerge. But yeah, I absolutely see a parallel between internet protocol development and Lightning and Bitcoin.
Yeah. And this, goes back to the fork war debates. And, it's like Bitcoiners were shouting from the rooftops, like, this is how we, develop protocols, man. We have 50 years of history to show that we do a layered approach, and here's why. And trying to cram everything on the base layer and make the base layer do all things is just impossible. It's inefficient, and it's just not going to be viable long term. And you're going to lose to us because we're taking the correct approach to engineering these protocols.
Yeah, and I think there's a really interesting talk. I almost wrote an article on this one time, but I haven't done it. There's a talk called Simple Made Easy, I believe it's called. Do you know about that one?
No, I don't.
Richard Hickey, I think. So he talks about how people conflate these two concepts of simple and easy. Like increasing the block size is very easy. You go into the code and you just like change a variable. Super easy, right? But the thing is that it's not simple because there's a lot of side effects to doing that, right? You have to think about what are the incentives that you change, for example, in the ways that fees are done, right? Because the reason we have fees on Bitcoin is because block space is scarce. We need the scarcity of block space for Bitcoin to be sustainable past the era when block rewards, shrink. So that's really important, right? And what other effects are you having? Are you creating more centralization? Because now miners have to be closer together in order to communicate blocks quickly enough with each other. So you have all these like second order effects from increasing the block size.
And even though it looks like a simple change, and it's way easier to go in and change a variable than it is to implement something like SegWit, simple is not always, you know, and easy aren't always the same thing. So SegWit, it looks complicated, but it actually reduces, it doesn't sort of have these second order complex effects that that increasing the block size does.
Yeah.
So I think that's something really critical. And a lot of people who are debating for these things may not have the background in development to make that assessment correctly. They don't understand trade-offs as well. And for them, it's like, I mean, you literally see people posting this. How hard is it to change a freaking variable to increase the block size? Yeah, it's really not hard. I can go in. It's really easy. You go in there and edit the number.
Yeah.
But what are you affecting? I mean, you're affecting an entire universe that's based on this concept of immutable sound money. And not only that, you're creating a second coin, by the way, by doing that,
yeah.
Right? Let's not forget what a hard fork actually is. You're creating a new coin. You have to have everybody accept this new coin as the real truth. Otherwise, you have two coins.
Right.
And that's exactly what we have.
You're fighting all the network effects of the protocols themselves and the money. You know, it's
right.
It's
and then what kind of precedent does that set? If we're saying this is sound money and we can go in and like change arbitrary things about the sound money, change its, you know, incentive structures on a whim, it's not sound money. It's not immutable. That these are the promises of Bitcoin. Immutability is the promise. Scarcity is the promise. By creating a new coin and saying this is a new Bitcoin, then you're literally breaking those promises. So I think people didn't really understand that enough.
Yeah. Do you think because of that, immutability is a promise, does that mean that we only have one chance at this, one chance at creating a digital scarce money? I mean, put aside the fact that the idea that there's some catastrophic thing that might, you know, damage Bitcoin that we have to like hard fork away to resolve that problem, like some 51% attack, and we have to, you know, brick everyone's ASICs by switching to a new, you know, hash algorithm or something. Put that aside, but do you think we have like one chance at this? If we somehow, you know, fail to maintain the scarcity or immutability, then we've just kind of like, I guess, tainted the whole project or the idea.
Well, I mean, I think that kind of yes, but I also think that it's that, like there's almost no way we can screw this up, because to screw this up, we would have to kind of like all agree that we're going to toss this thing away and make this other new thing and all switch to it. And then that new thing has to have these like problems in it, right? The nature of Bitcoin being immutable is not from the code, it's from the people who run these nodes, right? It's that people who are merchants or exchanges or service providers, like they run a node and that node tells them what Bitcoin is. And so I think that's the most baked in thing we have about the protocol. And so, yes, we have one chance of getting scarcity right, because if we have the cat's out of the bag, people know how Bitcoin works. There's already been 1,000 other alts. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for anybody to start one. But the one chance we have is on this particular thing that's attracted all the attention and all the liquidity and all the developers and all the merchants, right? Like it's got all these network effects. And so to say that we throw that away and start anew, it's almost like saying that the scarcity is actually reproducible. And so just by doing that, I think we break that promise. That's how I feel about it. And I think, like you said, if there's a bug and that bug is absolutely like catastrophic, then everybody will switch to a new code base and they will continue to enforce that, the rules of Bitcoin with this bug fixed. But I think also the nature of the way that the system is engineered makes it hard for having a bug like that, because remember, Bitcoin has been developed through a series of soft forks, it's a series of backwards compatible changes, essentially, right? So we even have people running old versions of clients. So if there's a bug in a new version, we still have all these people running old ones, and it continues to function just fine. And as far as we know, there aren't any catastrophic bugs in the current one. So things go on as normal, right? As long as that's true. And having a nice like stratification of people running different versions on the network helps actually ensure that we don't have any like one version dominating with a catastrophic bug in it. Whereas if you look at something like Ethereum, where they're like, okay, everybody has to hard fork, everybody has to upgrade their client. Oh, by the way, it's happening on New Year's Day. Good luck. And
right.
You know, this kind of mentality essentially ensures that people are programmed to just accept whatever new thing is coming out. They have to stay up with the system. And if they do that, then they're just essentially programmed to take any new changes. And one day that new change will include some kind of catastrophic bug. It's already included inflation problems. And you know, I don't want to get too deep in the Ethereum side, but that's what I see as kind of like governance by hard forks. That all it does is program people to accept blindly whatever changes are pushed onto them. Whereas with Bitcoin, you know, you can take your time to upgrade. There's no rush. Everything's backwards compatible. So, you know, take your time. This is what we've seen with SegWit. I mean, we have like, what, 60% or something like that penetration of SegWit. Oh, it's been almost 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
How long has it been? It's been a while.
Yeah, two and a half years or so.
Yeah.
It was like
it's been a while,
mid right? 20, August 2017, I think.
August 2017, right. So that just demonstrates that people in Bitcoin are super conservative. They upgrade slowly as they need to. And it's totally optional. You're not coerced into upgrading by somebody saying, do this on New Year's Day or you're no longer part of the system.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I don't want to get us, you know, off track onto Ethereum very much, but I do have one question there. You know, since you're like a application developer product guy, you know, and I heard on John Vallis's podcast, I heard you say that you kind of, when you discovered Bitcoin, kind of checked out ETH too, because the narrative there was that Ethereum was kind of more developer friendly for application developers. So taking that sort of experience and then applying it to what we have with Lightning now, do you think that we'll continue to see this sort of like movement of application developers from Ethereum over to Lightning?
I think we might. I mean, if people aren't super religious about it, I think that what Ethereum did really well was they marketed their marketed to developers really well. When I saw their website and it showed me 100 lines of code, you can implement your own bank. That's pretty cool. Okay, so you look at it as that as a developer who's ever done any kind of distributed system, and you know how hard distributed systems are, especially financial ones. And here's this thing that's promising you 100 lines of code, and you're done. It looks very attractive. And I think they made the language very friendly. They did a lot of things right on that side. So that caused a lot of developers to flock in and start developing. But I think you have to look at what the underlying system is. Is it actually money? Like if you're building a quote-unquote DeFi, you know, decentralized finance application, is the thing that you're transacting with actually money? I would argue no. I don't think Ethereum has monetary properties. And then, you know, is it going to scale? Again, I would argue no. There's a problem fundamental to trying to do like world computation on this scale with something that's supposed to be a permissionless system where like any kind of computer can join. And we're finding that out. But it's not every kind of computer. You have to have this massively powered thing running AWS to make it work, right? So so that's kind of where I see it. And I think that people are going to migrate more to Bitcoin development. I think that Bitcoin takes things a lot slower. So whereas if you're kind of like wanting to do blockchain today and you want to like, you know, quote unquote, do blockchain stuff, make a blockchain game, you go to Ethereum and you program your game and it like looks like it works. Until, of course, you get like 100 users and then, oops. Right? Like
crypto
what happened
with kitties. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it just totally clogged the system, right? Whereas you also have people now starting to make Lightning-based games where they're making just a traditional game. It's not, quote unquote, decentralized. But the most important part of it that is decentralized is right? That's the money. So you go to a game and inside of the game, there's like a Lightning QR code and you can pay Lightning to open a door in the game or buy in-game items or whatever. Like that makes sense, right? You have money inside of the game. So I think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see more development on Bitcoin. I do think that Bitcoin as an application platform is behind just with the tooling and stuff because it's just not as friendly, right? But I think we're getting there with Lightning. It's becoming a lot friendlier. It doesn't look as sexy as Solidity does, but then when you start doing Solidity, which is the Ethereum language, and you realize that, oh, there's all these security issues, scalability issues, the thing's not money, then all you're doing is prototyping anyway. So
right.
I think sooner or later people will realize this.
Yeah, I mean, there were some of the most experienced Solidity coders on the Parity team, which is, you know, one of the Ethereum's like most, I think it might be Ethereum's most used wallet, have made several mistakes over the years that have been catastrophic to people's money. So
they've cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think they're abandoning it now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just so volatile in that world over there. And you mentioned Lightning Gaming. There's just so much awesome development on that front. And I think Light Knight is going to be really cool. It's like a Fortnite clone on top of Lightning.
Oh, cool. I haven't even seen that.
Yeah. So you like frag somebody and you earn sats as you go. And like on the leaderboard, cool. Instead of like points for your team, you actually like can cash out Satoshis. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that we're super early to apps, and Ethereum rushed it a little bit. They kind of said, okay, this is done. Like we have a blockchain app platform, go and build, and then billions of dollars were poured in and stuff was built, and then there's no users, and the platform doesn't really work the way it was promised. Whereas with Bitcoin, I think there is a future there, but it is early. And I think it's legitimately early in the sense that it may be 5 or 10 years before we have really, really like world-class applications built on Bitcoin. But they will be built then on the right platform because they will be built around something that is actually considered money by people. So it's useless to pay people in something that's not money. That's kind of what we saw in a lot of these systems. Like you have BAT, you know, the basic attention token, where they wanted to pay people for attention. And that's not a bad idea, right? But if you're paying people with a token that they then have to sell for money, well, then that token's not going to have any value because then, you know, people just dump it. So that's what we're kind of, I think people are starting to realize that you have to build stuff on money. And that Bitcoin's scalability is not about transactions per second. Bitcoin scalability is about value settled per second. So if I can settle $1 billion in a single Bitcoin transaction, then it's extremely scalable. I don't need to necessarily have it do 10,000 transactions a second because no base monetary system does that, right?
Yep.
All money is layered. Even modern like fiat money is layered. You're not, when you pay a Visa transaction, you're not moving money around.
Yep.
This is an IOU that's settled way later in batches, right?
Right. Yeah. The further down the stack you go, it's just all batched up into larger and larger transactions.
Exactly. And that goes back to the idea of layering and batching and stuff that we know from engineering for many years and is intuitive if you really think about it. Like, how are you going to have something that does, 100,000 transactions per second that also runs on everybody's computer all over the world? It just doesn't it makes no sense. If you have any engineering background, it should be an immediate red flag when somebody promises you that.
Yep.
Especially if it's not a centralized platform all running in one data center.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit earlier, we were talking about conveniences, especially like when it comes to payments with money and how money is becoming more and more convenient. Cash is kind of inconvenient. We're moving to digital payments because of that. On the Andreas episode, I asked him if Bitcoin could ever catch up in convenience with, a centralized money, right? And he said, absolutely not. He said that decentralized tech could never match centralized tech for convenience. I'm not sure I agree with that. I was wondering what you thought about that. I mean, down the road.
Yeah, I don't see it as an all or nothing in terms of centralized or decentralized. For example, you could use your Visa card and then pay your bill in Bitcoin, right? Like that could be a future. So the Visa is fully centralized and the payments are fully centralized. And that would be one future, right? Another future would be the Lightning Network, where it actually develops into something very robust with a lot of liquidity. We solve all these kind of like UX problems because it's rough around the edges. Let's be real. It's really hard to onboard into Lightning right now. And I fully expect that will be the case for a little while until we figure out all these things. But yeah, another future is we use Lightning and we do a lot of Lightning transactions. Then we do like a batch settlement, or maybe we never settle. Maybe Lightning is so good, we stay on Lightning and it's a circular economy. Like there's a lot of different ways to attack this. And I'm kind of the mind that a hybrid solution, just like we talked about layers, a hybrid solution with a decentralized base layer of money and a centralized or semi-centralized layers above that could work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no reason why PayPal couldn't be transacting with Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
It's all about our convenience versus trust. If we can settle with PayPal once a day and we feel good about that, they're allowing us to withdraw once a day or something like that, then maybe that's what it is, right?
Sure.
Maybe they have Lightning withdrawals. So there could be a lot of ways that this shakes out. And I don't think looking at Bitcoin as, Bitcoin's base layer as the thing that's supposed to scale to this like consumer payment use case is the right approach. It just, yes, that won't happen. I don't think that there's any future where that happens. But having some kind of layered approach, I think, does make sense, whether it is centralized or decentralized.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that Bitcoin can, through great engineering and design, become nearly as convenient and through the series of trade-offs as the systems that we have now. And once you get on Lightning, sometimes the experience is incredible. It's almost as good as using Apple Pay or something.
Once you're on, it's great. I think once we have watch support, we can wave a watch in front of a payment terminal and like everything's completely abstracted away for you, then it'll be great. It'll be just like Apple Pay. There won't be, there's no reason for users to know that they're using Lightning.
Right.
Right. So we're not there yet. That's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's only a couple of years old. One place where I think the convenience trade-off concerns me a little bit is the convenience of holding your keys versus, having somebody custody your keys. I'm not sure that could ever be, like self-custody could ever be as convenient as a custodial solution. We're definitely making progress on that end. You know, I use Casa's multi-sig, and that interface is really nice. It was pretty simple for me to set up, but it's not nearly as simple as just going into Coinbase and buying some Coinbase and having it sit there.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think there's some innovations that we haven't really seen yet that may come. I mean, for example, you go 2 years ago before Casa even came out. I personally never thought about the idea of like a seedless setup where you just like launch an app and everything just works for you. Like you don't have to worry about backing up a seed.
Yep.
I think that's a really cool idea. There's like social backup where you can distribute seeds, to your friends, and it could be done behind the scenes. It could be fully encrypted. They won't know what they got. Like there's so many innovations around the corner. I think we're going to see more of that. And I do think we're going to get to the point where the custodial and non-custodial experiences are very close. I'm not writing them off just yet. I think that we're like in, 1990s internet here where like everything is super cumbersome and weird.
Yeah.
At the same time, however, like, in the 90s, the internet was kind of a fringe phenomenon. It was a bunch of geeks and we were willing to put up with the internet being weird and email being hard to use. But with Bitcoin, we have this weird pressure because it's in the media all the time and it's like $20,000. And so everybody's like, okay, this is this crazy new thing. It's going through the roof. And okay, I try to use it. And oh my God, it's so horrible. The user experience is so horrible.
It's true.
So we have an impedance mismatch between the hype and the where we are with the technology. But we're making huge strides. I mean, Casa or what Unchained is doing, all the multi-sig stuff is making life easier. It's just not where it needs to be with a polished UX. I think we're going to get there. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's finish up talking about some of your work. Of course, you've written Inventing Bitcoin. And I think Inventing Bitcoin's, is the best overview of Bitcoin as a system for new coiners. And I think that's what you intended it to be. Yeah.
Yes.
When I'm asked about, like what first to read to learn about Bitcoin, I go to the Little Bitcoin book just because it's so short and it does a good
love
overview.
That one too.
But then if that kind of hooks them, I recommend Inventing Bitcoin to learn about the system. And then I always push people toward The Bullish Case for Bitcoin to kind of describe how money works and how it should actually work and, why I buy Bitcoin, right? And then, you can get...
Yeah, I love that one too.
Yeah, me too. And I think that's just sort of like, like a gateway drug for the rest of it, like Bitcoin Standard, and then you're in, so that's sort of my little canon for new coiners. After you sold Reverb, I know you were working at Reverb, like you mentioned, and last year Reverb was acquired by Etsy, right?
Yeah, that's right. I actually left right before, well, not right before, but about a year ahead of that acquisition. Oh, so okay. I left in 2018. But by that time, we were pretty big. We were like 150 or so employees and doing like $600 million in sales. So I felt like the company was in a good place. And I was just, I was just so into Bitcoin that I couldn't do both jobs well, right?
Okay.
I couldn't be at Reverb, but also be focused on Bitcoin. And I decided that, after 5 or 6 years at that point, that the company was in a good place and I could actually focus a little bit on Bitcoin. And, I just thought that was the way I could make a difference in the world more than Reverb. Even though I love Reverb and I loved bringing music to people's homes and, spreading music through the world, that felt good for a while. But now I want to spread sound money through the world.
Right. You had some time after Reverb then to focus on Bitcoin. And obviously with your tech background, there was lots of ways you can contribute on that front. Why'd you decide to go the route of adding to the educational media in this space?
Well, I didn't know what I was going to do when I left Reverb. I just knew I wanted to do Bitcoin. Or really, to be honest, I just knew I wanted to do crypto. I wasn't yet a Bitcoin maximalist. I got into Bitcoin, like I said, I knew about it from 2011 and 2013, but by 2016, Ethereum was so loud that when I got off of Reverb, I started researching all of that stuff and had a phase where I basically looked at every single coin out there, looked at Bitcoin, looked at Ethereum, and then finally came back to Bitcoin understanding, having understood, that Bitcoin is more of this kind of like sound money, freedom money play. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I started giving talks at high schools. I had some friends who were high school teachers. My wife's a high school teacher. So I started going out to high schools giving talks and started writing notes for these talks and really quickly turned those notes into essays. And those essays started looking like chapters. And then I realized that what I'd written is half of a book.
Yeah.
So I started kind of like polishing that up. I really felt that what I was doing a lot was repeating myself to my friends. And I didn't have a great way to pitch Bitcoin. I was awkward at explaining it. And writing the book really helped me formulate those thoughts and put them into a concrete order. And you know, Bitcoin is very circular. It's very difficult to say, you know, how do you explain Bitcoin? Do you start with mining? Do you start with hashing? Do you start with, you know, digital signatures? Do you start with, you know, where did it come from? So I used the book to hone my way of thinking about Bitcoin. Of course, I consumed tons of pods and tons of other books while I was doing it, and it helped me to develop my own internal understanding even better. And I also was consulting for a while, just different Bitcoin companies and kind of like more on the technology infrastructure side. And so when the book finally came out, that's when I decided I was just going to kind of leave my consulting gigs and work just exclusively in the education sector, because I thought that was the biggest way to make an impact, right? To actually make, to bring more people into Bitcoin is really what we should be doing right now. A lot of people are building cool apps, and I think that's great, but it's so early. I mean, if we really look at kind of zooming out, maybe 0.5% of humanity has Bitcoin. So we're building apps for like the 0.5%, which is fine. They need the apps. They need the wallets. They need the, maybe they need the lending products and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, education is the biggest thing we can do to bring more people on. And that's why I'm focusing on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it makes sense why you've recently jumped on board with Give Bitcoin. You joined CEO Corey Clipston, came on as co-founder and CTO. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense because the goals of the Give Bitcoin and Save Bitcoin apps are, the stated goals are to bring in the next 21 million, or at least bring in 21 million new Bitcoiners.
Right. We want to be the best on-ramp, you know, for Bitcoin.
Right. And it's not just being an on-ramp, because there's lots of those, right? And I think this is probably what really brought you in, but there's an education component with the services.
Yeah, well, I really bucket that with on-ramping, because when you put people in Bitcoin and don't tell them what it is or how to use it or what they should do next, then you haven't really done them a service. I've onboarded a lot of people myself, just like one-on-one, red pilling people, giving them their first Bitcoin in their wallets. Like, it's such a painful process. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong, but it's painful in the sense that it's not scalable. I can't go around and do this to every person I meet. And it's also very like confrontational to like be like, hey, let me give you some Bitcoin right now. Let's go. We're going to learn about this. It's like, it's a lot. It's a lot to deal with. So I really love the idea that, you know, you buy your Bitcoin or you are gifted your Bitcoin, and then we drip you some knowledge, right? Like, here's a little bit about what money is. Here's a little bit about what Bitcoin is and why it's different from the money you might be used to. These are things that people need to consume on their own time and digest. And it's way easier that way than if you're trying to kind of like, you know, do a 5-minute cram session on what you just sent them to their wallet, and like they forgot to back up their keys, or they forgot about your Bitcoin entirely and deleted their app on their phone when they upgraded. Like, this stuff has happened to me. So I totally sympathize with onboarding new coiners, and that's why I thought Corey's idea was great and something very needed here.
How is Give Bitcoin providing education, and like, who's involved in putting that education stuff together?
Yeah, so we have a number of different folks from the Bitcoin space, people like Saifedean and Stefan Libera, Matt Odell, people who are basically advisors who help us with our curriculum. We have our head of education, Matt Ruby. He's really good at kind of collating all this stuff and coming up with the content. And then we all work together to make sure that it's good. It's something we can be proud of, that we can actually give to a new coiner and have them read through it and be engaged. Besides the written content, we're also putting together some videos, and maybe we'll even have some interactive stuff. We'll see. I think we're open to anything that helps people to understand what Bitcoin is and get on board.
So the Give product is custodial, and you guys delay the gifts for 1 year. Is it always 1 year now? I know that there was an option at first.
Yeah, we decided to eliminate the option that was part of like me coming on board. Is I'm like a hardcore simplicity kind of like proponent. I love to slash features.
Yeah.
So when I came in, I'm like, no, delete this. But yeah, I love simple products. So yeah, we're custodial for the first year, where the money's escrowed in a licensed and regulated custodian. They handle funds for companies like Bittrex and Binance. And I don't love custodianship, but we have to be realistic. When we onboard somebody like my mom or my grandma, they're not going to be able to take personal custody of the Bitcoin. Not yet, right? And that's kind of our goal. Our goal is to educate people on how and why they should take custody. But to expect somebody who's been gifted like a tiny amount of Bitcoin, whether it be like $10 or $50, to actually go through the effort of setting up their own wallet, not understanding it, or perhaps not even being able to understand it if they're at a certain age or a certain level of experience with technology, we can't expect that. I think a lot of hardcore Bitcoiners will want everybody to go fully self-sovereign right away, but we have to be absolutely realistic. So we encourage them to do that, and we teach them how to do that on the way, on their journey, right? So we drip them this information, we start to give them onboarding emails, and eventually they will learn how to do this. And when their time lock is up, which is a year from when the Bitcoin was gifted, then we will absolutely handhold them and help them take personal custody. And the nice thing is, if we wait a year, we might even see new developments in wallets that make it way easier, like what we saw with Casa. I mean, who knows what Casa is going to look like a year from now? It may be so easy that we just stop doing custodial entirely. I'd be more than happy to do that if I felt like people didn't have to go through all these like crazy steps to understand how to custody their own Bitcoin, make it safe for backup from theft, from getting hit by a bus, what happens to their account, if nobody can access it.
Yeah.
Like, these are real questions for beginners. And let's keep in mind that most people use a single password across all their websites. That's where we're at today. So expecting them to understand the level of security required to secure Bitcoin is a little bit unrealistic. And that's why we escrow. And then after that, we teach, and then they take custody.
Yeah. Yeah. And it helps the people who are receiving these gifts really avoid some of those common new coiner mistakes, like you're saying. Like, I mean, just to name a couple, like panic selling is a huge one.
Panic selling, yeah. If they have it on Coinbase, this is a common one, right? Panic selling or trading for another coin.
Yeah.
And this is why I used to send people to Coinbase. I thought it was a good user experience. Now I just send people to Square. That's, until we have safe Bitcoin, that's going to be my onboarding mechanism, because it's easy. You open up an app and you hit a button, right?
And there's no shitcoins.
There's no shitcoins. That's the thing, right? It has to be as simple as you see a number, you press a button, and you're done.
Yeah.
And if it's not that simple, then we haven't done our job. So that's where we're at. If you present people with all these other coins, and it's not because I'm religious about Bitcoin, it's because I'm a market realist. I understand the value of Bitcoin as a scarce resource. I don't understand the value of these other things, and I definitely don't want to have my mom try to ask me questions about why she should or should not buy Litecoin or Ethereum, or why it went down 90% and when she should sell it. Like, these are ridiculous questions. This is just confusion for newbies, and I'm very sad that Coinbase went that way, and that they're even offering people money to learn about these other coins, right? I mean, it's a bad way to get people onboarded, but that's their business model, so that's fine. Our business model is to really focus on Bitcoin, to be absolutely pure to that ideology, and to teach people why they should value their gift, right? We don't care if they hear about other coins. Most people haven't, right? If you talk about people on the street, most of them have heard about Bitcoin. Almost none of them have heard about Ethereum. Right. We have a very delusional kind of or skewed view of the universe when we look at Twitter, because there's all this debate, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash. Your average person on the street has never heard of these things. So why even show it to them? Show them Bitcoin, let them onboard to Bitcoin.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
The mindshare dominance for Bitcoin is so huge, right? I mean, the market
it's
cap
way
dominance
higher than
is
the
big.
Market's dominance.
Yes,
yeah.
It's massive.
I think it's like 99-1. If that, I think it's 99.9.
Yeah,
I mean, honestly.
Yeah. So what are the latest developments that are in progress right now? What can we expect from Give, and what's Save going to look like when it launches?
Yeah, we're kind of thinking through Save right now. We want to make sure that we do offer a non-custodial option if we can. I think for saving, there's absolutely no reason that people should go custodial unless they want to, right? If they want to, like, tell their mom to get onto Save and help her do a custodial account, totally cool. We'll support that. But we are definitely thinking through how we can best do a non-custodial version, a straight-to-wallet purchase type of flow. Minimize the amount of KYC required. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you have to do because of regulations.
Yeah.
That, honestly, it sucks. I think KYC is absolutely horrible. I think it's it creates massive honeypots of user information, but it's what the government wants us to do. So we have to play by the rules since we're in the United States. And so, yeah, we're looking at different partners and different opportunities to do that properly. And also making sure that the user experience is absolutely slick. So we're working with a designer to kind of really polish it up, making sure that there's no hiccups in the process. Same thing with Give. We're kind of like just polishing up the flow, making sure it's as simple as possible, and ensuring that people have a great experience. Whether they choose to go custodial or not, we need to make sure that they have that that experience that's absolutely stellar and best in class.
Yeah. So the differentiator then for both the products is going to be like the education, the sense of community, and just the absolute dedication to Bitcoin. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is. And I think the level of focus enables us to be super lean, right? We can have a small surface area for the product. We can have really tight user experience. We can have good marketing that's really, really focused on Bitcoin. And without distractions, we should be able to make this a very good product for both customers and for us internally, right? Because when you're only supporting one coin, then you're worrying about that one coin's characteristics, how to secure it, how to store it, how to onboard people. I think we're going to deliver a better experience than a company that's focused on many coins.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm really excited about Save and what Give is doing. And you guys keep up the great work, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for joining me today. Take care.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks to Jan for joining me for a fun discussion. I'm excited about the work those guys are doing at Swan Bitcoin with the Give and Save products. Let us know your thoughts and questions about the episode. Jan is at SKWP on Twitter. I am at Citizen Bitcoin. And that's really the best way to support the podcast, sharing it out on Bitcoin Twitter. Let us know what you thought, questions you had, parts you liked. You can share it with your family and friends, of course, too. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. And check out layer1btc.com for the Citizen Bitcoin merch collection. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring the episode and to LTBN for distributing the podcast on their amazing feed for Bitcoin content. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. Always happy to talk to y'all. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram and Keybase. And my email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. This week's open source shout out goes to Raspy Bolt. Raspy Bolt is built by Staticus, a longtime Bitcoin builder. It's software to make setting up a Bitcoin and Lightning node on a Raspberry Pi very easy. Raspy Bolt 2 just landed, and it works on a Raspberry Pi 4, and it works with hardware wallets, which is very cool. It's a very fun project. You get your hands a little dirty on the hardware and software side of running Bitcoin and Lightning. Find out about Raspy Bolt at staticus.github.io/raspybolt. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world. Thank you.